Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the world economy actually need cash, or are we approaching a moment where literally every legitimate transaction is conducted digitally? Given the ubiquity of credit and debit card acceptance by retailers, many of us carry around fewer bills and coins than we once did. Many pay bills online. And ventures like Google Wallet give consumers the power to pay via mobile phone, a technology now used by staggering numbers of people not only in wealthy economies, but also in the developing world. So how would a truly cash-free economy change the way we do business, and could it also change the way we live? David Wolman is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. He writes about all this in his new book, The End of Money: Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. David, welcome to Think.
Hi there, Chris.
So we want to start by acknowledging that money, of course, is a far broader concept than cash. But so many of us, when we talk about money in our pockets, we're thinking about paper bills and we're thinking about metal coins.
Right. The title of The End of Money, obviously, is kind of intentionally misleading. I'm talking about the end of physical money or the end of cash. And, you know, money certainly will persist, if not flourish, into the digital future. But I think that, you know, even the Wall Street banker who is, you know, hawking subprime mortgages, when he or she hears the word money, you know, even they are hearing that and envisioning a big pile of Benjamins, right? when that word hits our ears, to a certain degree, we all picture that pale green paper and that fistful of cash. So that's the idea I was sort of needling at here.
And it's really an artificial construct that cash represents the concept of money to us, because it has always stood for something that's a little bit amorphous.
Very. And stood for something, I think that's a nice turn of phrase. You know, money is just an idea. The idea that I own something, or the idea that this toothbrush or this stone or this piece of paper could be a medium of exchange for you and me during a transaction, or that it could be a store of value. You know, modern day money, in whether physical or electronic, you know, it only has value because we believe it has value, and we believe that the issuing institution, you know, the central bank of this country or another country, won't necessarily go belly up tomorrow or next month, and so we all are okay to play along with this. This hallucination, which is, you know, sounds scary, but on the other hand, it's also quite beautiful that it works as well as it does, and that this, we are okay with this idea of trusting one another.
So we trust one another, of course, for electronic banking to work fully if we have no cash in play. We also have to trust our financial institutions. And I wonder about the hit that trust took in the meltdown of 2008.
Absolutely. And excuse me, you saw a lot of people actually retreating from the form of electronic money known as credit and debit cards in the wake of the financial meltdown, precisely because of that sort of hit to the trust that people have in financial institutions. And, you know, many people who sort of jump to cash's defense will say, well, you know, I don't trust government or banks very much, but I trust the government a little more than banks. So I would like to keep cash around, because if we don't have any, then, you know, does that mean that the monetary system and my financial transactions are sort of entirely at the mercy of private corporations? And that's a concern. You know, I tried to unpack it a little bit and challenge those ideas somewhat in the book, you know, not because I don't also have concerns about privacy or Big Brother or corporations that have too much power. But, you know, what's peculiar, Chris, is to such a great extent we have said yes to electronic money in our lives, right? I imagine you don't pay your mortgage by way of a dollar bill briefcase that you truck down to the bank, you know, let alone when you're buying a new sweater or making a car payment or tuition for a child's education. And, you know, all of that is electronic money now. And we've pushed cash very far to the edge of the cliff, really. And, you know, my idea with this book was to kind of wander over to the edge of the cliff and say, hey, well, you know, we've pushed cash this far. You know, how much more terrain is actually here before it falls off the edge of the cliff? And do we want to give it a nudge, or do we need to scramble to preserve it? You know, we've marginalized it to such a great extent, and yet, you know, only when you kind of shine the spotlight on that fact and consider whether, you know, it's going to be extinct soon, then people sort of recoil and say, no, 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 I don't want the big banks to have control over my life, or I don't want, you know, government to have traceability capable. You know, I don't want the government to have the ability to trace all of my transactions and all that. And yet, you know, unless you're living in a cabin in Montana off the grid, sort of Unabomber style, you're already a known quantity to an extent. So, you know, that was kind of a peculiar inconsistency that I wanted to see if I could explore in the book.
Well, let's talk about this. Cash is still a significant part of our economy for certain kinds of transactions. And I think many of us forget that it is a relatively expensive element. We don't think about the cost of cash because we don't think about paying it. But governments have to mint money. Banks have to store it and transfer it. People who get it have to get it to that bank or take it out of an ATM. Can you talk a little bit about the cost to a cash system and how it compares with the cost, because there is one, of electronic transactions?
Sure. And it's interesting. You're absolutely right. You know, we never think of that. You know, why? Why is cash, why has it gone so uncontested for so long? And a lot of that, of course, has to do with sort of the psychology and psychological tricks that, that money plays on our minds. I mean, who doesn't want a briefcase full of cash, right? It symbolizes power and purchasing power, and hopefully could help someone build financial stability in his or her life. And yet, cash is very expensive. It seems fast and cheap and quick and easy, but it's none of those things. So, you know, you started with sort of the level one costs of so-called cash management. You know, you have to manufacture the stuff and inspect it and distribute it and count it and secure it and reinspect it and circulate it back to a Federal Reserve Bank at some point, and then after so many uses, they'll shred it and redesign it and print a new one. So cash management in the U.S., we're looking at about $150 billion a year, which is roughly three times the budget of the Department of Education. So that's just level one, though. Okay, so then you look to other government agencies and wonder a little bit, well, what are they spending on cash? Or really, what do they have to spend because of cash? So one area, for example, is the question of the tax gap, this gap between what Americans owe and what they pay. And the best estimates right now are that the tax gap is about $400 to $500 billion a year. And all of that evasion, you know, is not necessarily cash-enabled, but a lot of it is. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we can't know exactly how much because that's the whole point of cash, right? It's anonymous, so you can't track it very easily. But this is a huge problem that obviously, you know, every other taxpayer has to clean up after in the sort of coughing up funds sense of it. Then you have to ask, well, you know, what about FBI? What do they have to spend because of cash, because they're chasing down the mafia or looking for aspiring terrorists who are laundering money? Because, of course, cash is the currency of crime, right? Mm-hmm. So DEA is fighting the war on drugs with your tax dollars and my tax dollars. And whatever you think of the war on drugs, again, cash is the currency that greases that whole enterprise. And, you know, if you did away with cash tomorrow, there would still certainly be financial crime. But you make business much harder right away for, you know, many, many criminals out there, not, you know, from pimps to bank robbers to drug dealers to tax evaders. And, you know, this is an idea that I think it's just sort of either hasn't gone noticed or is just unpopular because it has a sort of anti-Robin Hood reek to it or something. I'm not sure exactly why. But yet, I mean, in the United States, we had 10,000 bank robberies over a period of 2 years recently. I mean, and that's just people going after the physical stuff. So, again, you know, you and I, we have to pay for that, not just the cost of what's taken. That's puny compared to, you know, repairs at the bank and counseling for the employees or injuries. And then, of course, you know, we have to chase down those crooks and prosecute and incarcerate in overcrowded prisons and the whole bit, you know, all because of the paper. And that really was surprising to me. You know, I started this project thinking it would be kind of a half Valentine, a half eulogy to these little rectangular slips of paper and coins. And yet, very early in my research, I realized, you know, the cash is extremely expensive, and actually there are much bigger ramifications to this discussion about the twilight of cash or the potential twilight of cash.
Talk about this. There is sort of an emotional attachment to cash that we have to consider here.
Absolutely. And I think there are a few different threads to that. Some of it is just the simple, you know, ever since you lost a tooth and reached your hand under the pillow, there was a coin, right? You know, money has this kind of magic power over us. It reminds us of our youth and grandparents' gifts tucked into cheesy Hallmark cards and wishing wells. And, you know, we have a truly deep emotional connection to physical money. The other way, or another way, that we have this connection is the tactile experience of relinquishing funds, right? So many people out there say, excuse me, that I'm fearful of the cashless future because I'm more careful with my money when I have it in physical form, and I carry cash around. And sort of the extreme version of that is people who I speak to in the book from Debtors Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
They will, at the beginning of every month, withdraw funds from a bank account that precisely match, you know, what they have to pay for utilities and gas and groceries and rent, and then earmark that money, or actually literally put it in separate envelopes, you know, with those categories written on them. And that's the money that they spend down every month, because they're very fearful of debt and credit cards or debit cards, and that the fees and penalties that might be involved in using those. Now, I should say that, you know, electronic money comes in many different forms. It's not only credit and debit cards. And yet, when you talk to people about the idea of going cashless, number one, they immediately think that the corollary is credit and debit cards. And number two, they get this idea that, oh, no, I'm going to go even more into debt than I am now if you take my cash away. And that's something I think technologists need to be extremely sensitive to. I mean, right now, Americans owe about $800 billion on their credit cards.
Hmm.
So, you know, you could be the most tech enthusiastic person on the planet, but I think it would be sort of asinine to welcome the cashless future prematurely. You know, prematurely in the sense that we don't have technologies to help those people who have been plagued by debt and who really see cash, rightly or wrongly, as a way to fight back a little bit against debt or the temptation to overspend.
So these days, David, just about everybody who has a bank account, and we'll talk about those who don't in a couple of minutes, but just about everybody who has a bank account can probably get a debit account, but not everybody can get a credit card. Is that not a factor here?
Sure it is, but you know, none of this is about encouraging people to get a credit card per se. It's more the other side of the coin. Ha ha ha. It's talking about the cost of cash itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, credit cards represent credit money in electronic form. So that's not even a store of value, right? It's a short-term loan, actually, when you pay for something with a credit card. So, you know, debit card is a different animal, and I think you're right that includes more people could get those. But I don't think necessarily that credit cards are the antidote to the costs of cash. But I think what we need is a more honest accounting of the costs of these various forms of money, right? So many people know the costs of credit cards because they've failed to pay their balance down to zero at the end of the month and they got charged with interest. Or they know a local donut shop that won't accept credit cards because the merchant fee is too high.
Mm-hmm.
So, but cash has escaped the same kind of scrutiny because it's hard to see the costs of cash. They're not quite as upfront for the individual, partially because I think of the pixie dust element of cash in hand. It feels fast and clean and pure. And then part of it has to do with the fact that those costs are more kind of social or socioeconomic costs and not necessarily at the individual level.
My guest is journalist David Wolman. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine and author of the new book, The End of Money: Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Woolman is my guest this hour. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine and has a new book out called The End of Money: Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's talk, David, about the people who do not have bank accounts. And we might think about, you know, the developing world, but in fact, there are a significant number of people in this country who do not have a regular relationship with a financial institution.
Right. The number that I've seen is about 20 million Americans don't have a bank account. And so what does that really mean? Because a relationship to a financial institution, you know, that sounds, in the post-recession era, that sounds precarious at best. And yet, for you and me, you know, having a bank account in the very boring sense of it, a safe and secure way to store your wealth, you know, that really is a service that we take for granted. You know, we just never think that that it is really kind of a public service. And, of course, you know, banks are businesses like any other. But the benefits to having a bank account are almost so blasé to you and me that it's something that's sort of off the radar screen. And yet, imagine if you didn't have that and all of a sudden you had to store your wealth under your mattress and you did have to pay your mortgage and your car loan payments with cash, you know, let alone, you know, every meal, every sofa, everything was cash. I mean, you know, I tried to spend the whole year going without cash for this book project. It's kind of a meditation on the subject, but in fact, it would have been an order of magnitude more difficult to just go all cash for the whole year. And so there would be tremendous costs for you and for me if we had to live entirely with cash. We could do okay, though. You know, it wouldn't be so impossibly punitive. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you and I are going out to dinner tonight and you just have a penchant for cash and want to use it, so you go to an ATM and you get some cash and it takes you 20 minutes or 45 minutes, which is costly for you, but it's not crushing, right? Well, when you are poor or on the poverty line or what have you, the cost of transacting in cash are magnified, and really the distribution of the cost of cash are skewed so that the poor pay much more for those costs. Because if you don't, you know, let's say you don't have a car or a bank account, well, now you have to spend the entire afternoon getting to a check cashing service that's going to charge you this ridiculous fee just to turn a check into cash that then you can then use, and hopefully you won't get robbed on your way back home. For me, this was sort of a thread in the book that was really revelatory. I didn't understand this concept that cash is the enemy of the poor until I was looking at this question of the unbanked and what does it mean not to have a bank account? What does it mean not to have access to electronic money? And of course, those costs are only amplified further when you travel to the developing world, right? So a bank transaction costs, let's say, a dollar. Well, if you're part of, like, the 2 billion people on Earth who are trying to get by on just $2 a day, you know, those costs are crushing. And meanwhile, the expense of transacting in cash and the risk to your well-being that costs you is tremendous. And so that's why a lot of development people are talking about cash as really the enemy of the poor, and I feature this Gates Foundation economist in the book. You know, they recently gave like $500 million to these programs to support innovation, to get people in developing countries using their mobile phone as a digital wallet and as basically a miniature bank branch in your pocket, so you don't have to, you know, so the obstacles to accessing electronic money are much more manageable now.
I'm really interested in the digital wallet through mobile phone, and Google has a product for this and some other competitors as well. Of course, there are the silly questions of what if your phone runs out of juice just as you need to buy a tank of gas in a, you know, a remote location or something. There are times when it's comforting to have a piece of plastic in your pocket or even better, some bills.
It's true. And, you know, I think the discussion would be silly if anybody thought that they were sincerely advocating for the end of cash tomorrow. You know, not only everybody's device's battery power goes to zero issue, but then let's say you have a natural disaster. You know, here on the West Coast, The American Red Cross advises everybody to have some cash in their earthquake preparedness kit. You know, so it would be silly to say that, you know, that's wrong and we should all ditch cash tomorrow or even 4 years from now. You know, another area is, let's say, tipping. You've got millions of people in the U.S. alone who depend on cash tips for, you know, a huge portion of their income. So until there is a technology or technologies to make up for that need, you know, it would be foolhardy to advocate enthusiastically for the end of cash, right? All of that is kind of premature. What I think we're seeing instead is kind of a death by a thousand cuts scenario and, you know, a huge category of cuts includes new technologies, right? So PayPal, mobile, and Google Wallet and all these other apps, for example. But another category of cuts, I think, is sort of renewed scrutiny as to the cost of cash. I think people are waking up to that fact. It's not necessarily let's get rid of cash tomorrow, but, for example, the Canadian government just last week, they said no more pennies. They're mm-hmm. going to eliminate manufacturing the penny in Canada, like in many countries, because it's just not worth it. And then you have this yet another category of cutting underway, which I think is arguably the most exciting, which is the area of alternative currencies and virtual currencies and community currencies. People saying, you know, maybe it's time to end the government monopoly on issuing currency. And there are a number of different reasons people want to do that. You know, one of which is as simple as just anxiety about national currencies. You know, what gives a dollar worth, or why is a euro, and is the euro even going to survive? You also have enthusiasm in that area relating to the idea of kind of community-mindedness along the line of, let's say, eating local, for example. You know, why do you want to buy a new sofa at CreightonByArtBarrel.com, paid for with a Visa card, manufactured in India, when instead you could be buying a sofa made from the furniture maker around the corner in your community? And so people are innovating new currencies to support that kind of local economy as well. And of course, these things are really taking off in the digital realm. So I think all of these different forces are sort of ganging up on cash, but it would never be a kind of deliberate government effort to say, like, okay, as of February 15th, 2020, well, we will not be using cash anymore. I think it's much more so that it's going to get pushed further and further toward to the margins, so that eventually you will look at cash like you look at a payphone today. You know, it's really kind of this anachronism that maybe a few people here and there are still using them, but 20 years from now, nobody is, because nobody sees the benefit of doing so, and nobody needs to.
And nobody's carrying the quarters to exactly. plug into that payphone. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go first on the phone lines to Abby in Irving. Hi, Abby.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that that really sounds like an interesting book. I'll definitely read it out. My question to the author is, like, as he was discussing about Canada doing away with pennies, let's say 10 years from now, if they do away with cash totally, what, according to you, will be the potential pitfalls, or what are the advantages of having such a system?
The advantages? I'm sorry, I missed that last.
Yeah, sort of the pros and cons of a cashless system.
Right. Well, there are many. You know, if depending on one's personal ideas on the thing, you know, a con would be that now technically all of your transactions to some degree are traceable, and, you know, that frightens a lot of people. On the other hand, you know, most of your transactions today are already traceable, and I try to make the argument in the book that, you know, we need to be extremely worried about privacy in the digital age, whether it's Facebook gathering data about us or scrutiny on the part of banking institutions or what have you. But capital P privacy and anonymity are different things. And, you know, I would posit that not only do most people not actually want anonymity because they want law enforcement to have some kind of break-the-glass access to, you know, to financial records or to transaction history so that they can chase down a money launderer or aspiring terrorist or what have you, and that the people who are most vocal about the anonymity benefits of cash are, by and large, you know, really just people who want a free ride, right? They don't want to pay their taxes. They They don't want to participate in modern society in a way that most of us just get it, that to be part of a democracy, you know, you kind of have to play by the rules. And like it or not, that means paying your taxes and probably having a driver's license and planning to collect Social Security. And all of that already means you are a known quantity to a certain degree. So anonymity is already a non-starter right there. But again, that is not to hastily dismiss the concerns about privacy, which we definitely should have. But I think, I don't think it's just semantics to try and distinguish between what is privacy and what is anonymity in the cashless future. Some other benefits, you know, I think those costs of cash that I was trying to tick through earlier a little bit, certainly there will be crime in the digital future, but many criminal enterprises that depend on cash or just love the stuff, that, you know, life would be made harder overnight for them. I mean, think of people who are just trying to counterfeit physical notes. You know, this is a huge workload for the U.S. Secret Service when they're not protecting the highest offices in the land. They're chasing around kids who are high on meth who want to bleach a $5 bill and reprint the image of a 20 on that same paper and then try and go buy something with that quote-unquote money. And, you know, so if you eliminated cash or even just the high-value notes, then right away, you know, that whole, right away the Secret Service's workload would be alleviated a little bit.
Talk about this. I mean, it seems like a small concern, but in the era of global pandemic concerns, money's also really dirty.
I know. I mean, what other objects are there that we would see, like, down in the gutter, that people would bend down and pick it up and assign this kind of sense of proud ownership to the thing and tuck it in their wallet? Right.
And encourage
our
kids to do the same thing. Yeah.
Right next to our gym membership and pictures of our kids. You know, and that's peculiar, but again, it's sort of the captivating power of these objects. And, you know, it doesn't have to be that highfalutin. It's also the purchasing power of these objects. And if it's a $50 bill lying in the gutter there, you know, that's not a non-trivial amount of money to many, many people. But yes, cash is filthy. And this was, during my year of eschewing cash, I kind of morphed into a much more of a germphobe than I ever thought I would be, because I was just watching people transacting cash all the time. And then, you know, the barista would then go on to pour my coffee after handling someone's banknotes at the register. And I'm just dreaming of more hand sanitizer everywhere, more hand sanitizer. And I talked in the book briefly about a study out of Switzerland, I think it was, where they tried to grow the influenza virus on these banknotes. And they were disgustingly successful, but the good news is there won't be like a pandemic due to cash-enabled transmission of some really nasty. But that doesn't change the fact that they're still filthy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to David in Mansfield. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Love your show. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
I had a question for him. He seems to be talking about possibly going towards a cashless system as one option in the future. I was just wondering if he could talk about how that would leave our banking system vulnerable to electronic attacks, almost like a Fight Club scenario. Maybe not as drastic, but something like that.
Well, I think to a certain extent we are, unfortunately, already vulnerable in that way. In that, you know, cash already is only a small portion of the whole money supply, which actually surprises a lot of people more than I would have thought. But, you know, at the bank, there's no drawer with a piece of masking tape on it and your and Chris written on it in a Sharpie, inside of which that, you know, that drawer holds all of this paper representing the money that you have. You know, most money is already zeros and ones on computers. And so, in that sense, the sort of doomsayer talk about catastrophic banking collapse or a cyber attack on the banking system, it would pretty much make things horrible already, even if we weren't entirely cashless. However, the caller is absolutely right that, let's say that happened tomorrow, you know, we do have cash in hand or in the economy with which we could do some transacting. You know, not nearly enough, but we have that paper. So there is the sort of you know, huge natural disaster scenario or banking collapse scenario, when it does look like having these physical representations of the national currency, it does make sense. Or, you know, unless we have a bunch of $5 and $10 bills, like kind of American Red Cross currency issued by the American Red Cross, sitting in our earthquake preparedness kit, just for when things go that bad, you know, maybe this really is a legitimate justification for having cash around for the long term.
What do we know about the vulnerability of cash versus electronic transactions to just simple human error? You know, either you hand back the wrong amount of cash or you type in a decimal point where it doesn't belong.
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting. There's a snippet in the book when I'm talking about sort of different cultures' receptivity to new technologies. And in Japan, for example, people are, it's definitely a kind of early adopter kind of society, whereas Americans are much more skeptical about new technologies. And this traces back as far as you want to go. You know, when they first started putting radios in automobiles, everyone thought, you know, this is it. This is Armageddon. It's going to be the end of the world. And there'll be accidents all over the place. And then, you know, people sort of slowly warmed to the idea, and now people can just listen to NPR in the car, and that's that. And in Japan, when they came out with ATMs that would accept deposits, mm-hmm. not just provide you with your cash for withdrawal, people jumped to them. They were using them no problem. But in the U.S., you know, they're here now and people are using them, but they took a much longer amount of time to become popular. And many people are still very skeptical of them because they prefer to hand a check or deposit to a banker, to a bank teller, and not to a machine. When, of course, there is a mountain of data indicating that actually the errors occur much less frequently when you're using the computer than when you're using a teller. In other words, it's the human teller who is going to make an error that could be costly either to the bank or to you, the depositor. But, you know, we're human beings. We like to interact with other human beings and not necessarily machine. And so I think that, coupled with our skepticism and our worries about technologies, makes people reluctant to deposit a check.
David Wolman is here. His new book is called The End of Money. We'll take a quick break and be back. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David Wolman. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine and author of the new book, The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. David, we haven't really talked about this, but, you know, members of Debtors Anonymous who have trouble managing their money, notwithstanding, using electronic methods to manage and spend one's money make it a lot easier to know where that money is going, to track spending, to basically be a responsible consumer.
Well, I like hearing you say that because I think people are more emotional and more worried about cash's proclivity to be spent. And yet I also do hear from people who say, no. When I have cash on me, that, you know, I'm not holding it carefully. I'm not accounting carefully. I just end up spending it. And at the end of the day, I wonder where it went. So even though I'm quite sympathetic to the Debtors Anonymous mindset, I actually think it's not so cut and dry that for some people having cash on them actually is problematic. And you're absolutely right that for people who use, you know, digital tools, even something as old-fashioned as Quicken, for example, or more recent innovations like a personal finance manager called Mint.com, you know, these are ways to try and get a better grip on where your money is and how it's being allocated and what your spending habits are. And, you know, I think the people who are delivering these technologies could do 20 times more to help us and be more responsible with our spending. But But I do think it's faulty to just say that money in electronic form equals less responsible financial behavior.
Yeah, we have two kids in middle school at home, and we're starting to talk about teaching them to manage money. And they have these accounts now where you can get a debit card for like a middle school or high school student. And in a way, it seems terrifying. And yet that how are you going to learn how money is really spent if you're just using $20 bills from grandma and babysitting money in cash?
Right, right. Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Garland. We have Ken on the line there. Hey, Ken. Hello, Ken. Are you with us? Okay, we will go instead to Tom in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, Chris. It's an interesting show.
Thank you.
Are you saying in the title of the book that one of the professions is preacher? Is that one of the names in the title of the book? I didn't understand.
Oh, yeah, preacher. You should tell that story, David.
Sure. So, yes, the word preachers, among many others, I should say, is included in the rather windy subtitle of the book. And the reason there is because one of the first characters who I introduced sort of along the trail here is a pastor in Georgia who wrote a book called Steps Toward the Mark of the Beast. And for many people who have a sort of literal interpretation of the book of Revelation, this idea of going cashless is very frightening because it would mean that all financial transactions are now traceable and that without cash as an anonymous means of transaction, the Antichrist could really seize control of all financial activity as prophesized, and that would mean that Armageddon is just around the corner. And, you know, whether or not one is a subscriber to those ideas, the pastor who I spoke with, you know, he did a really good job of illuminating the fears that people have about the cashless future, irrespective of whether they were sort of pegged to the book of Revelation, because even that view is representative of the more everyday anxieties that people have about Big Brother, about privacy, about banking institutions with too much power. And so that's why I wanted to make sure that preachers were involved in this book. And the other reason I wanted to talk a little bit about religion, of course, is because of this idea of faith and faith in the almighty dollar and the notion that the only thing that gives money value is belief that it is valuable. And the only thing that makes it widely accepted is the fact that we believe it will be widely accepted, and we believe so because we believe it's valuable. And you kind of go around and around in circles with this stuff. And yet the language of religion, I think, is really important in that discussion because, it is faith. You know, money really is an idea, and we have to believe that it works in order for it to work.
We've got an email here from Rob who writes, if we went to paperless currency, wouldn't that be the end of many national currencies, especially for smaller countries? And would the U.S. dollar retain its role in international trade?
That's a great question. You know, there's a section in the book where I traveled to Iceland to do a kind of post-mortem after their banking collapse there, but through the lens of cash and national currency. You know, at the time, people in Iceland were talking about ditching the Icelandic krona, their national currency, to get on the euro. Now, of course, that sounds kind of crazy because everyone is so worried about the euro, and people in Iceland are sighing a sigh of relief that they're not on the euro.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, that was the case, right? And there's this question of consolidation of currencies, especially in poorer countries. You know, do we need to have Somali shillings around? You know, they don't even have a central bank, really. And so I think it's a little early to tell as far as if we were a completely cashless society. I think what it would do, it would make people a little bit more sophisticated in their analysis of whether we actually need national currencies for each country, or do you really need a national currency to be a country? And in that sense, I think we will see some consolidation. The U.S. dollar's role as the backbone to the monetary system, that's not going to change anytime soon because everybody depends on the U.S. dollar, but, its dominance is being challenged here and there for sure, you know, and that has to do with government debt, it has to do with the rise of China, it has to do with other countries worrying about Washington paralysis. But, you know, it gets pretty heady and macroeconomics talk pretty fast here. But I think the digital future will raise a lot of these interesting questions about national currencies and other currencies too, right? You and I were mentioning earlier the explosion of interest in alternative and community currencies. So what you might be seeing on your phone someday is that you could trade in dollars and euros, but you could just with a click convert those into airline miles or Disney dollars or Bitcoin or Ithaca hours or Zen or Facebook credits. Just with a few taps on the screen of your phone. So hopefully there will be more currency options out there for people.
Yeah, those alternative currencies are interesting because on the one hand, as you mentioned, certain local currencies could encourage people to shop at, say, the farmer's market in town or the hardware store or whatever. On the other hand, it is a form of currency that doesn't carry any value outside of a particular area, and people are limited as to how they can spend that capital.
Yes, and I think that's the distinction. You know, some of this, again, is semantics with the naming of these things. But,
sure.
You know, that's a community currency with a kind of capital C to it, I think. And the whole goal is to keep people transacting locally, you know, buy from the local baker and not from, you know, not whatever Walmart is selling that was made elsewhere and trucked in. But what you can see online now is a version of alternative currencies that transcends the geographic boundaries that you were just mentioning. And in that case, the ethos isn't necessarily eat local or shop local. It's more has to do with criticism of central banks and skepticism about whether the Federal Reserve is steering the national currency in a responsible manner. And so instead of using that, we will use the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, for example. So you see kind of motivation to participate in and innovate in the alternative currencies world coming from sort of various camps.
Do we need to worry in a cashless world that for-profit financial institutions will have more control rather than less over our financial transactions? I mean, they've got a great deal now.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think we do need to worry about that. But number one is what you just said. We should worry about that already. And number two is it may turn out that as we get that much closer to cashlessness, it will kind of wake people up to these realities and force them to be a little bit more sophisticated in their understanding about what money is and what gives it value and who is safeguarding its value. And, you know, the credit card company is charging me such and such fee, but if I use this alternative currency online, maybe I could reduce the friction in my financial life. And so in a way, getting rid of cash might open people's eyes up to the fact that different forms of money all cost money. There are costs to dealing with money. So I'm going to seek out the vendors or the banks that help me minimize those costs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Dick in Dallas. Hello, Dick.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I think you're just touched on my topic, which was, you know, like a natural disaster or other calamity where there's no electricity and, you know, a cashless society couldn't function when you need to, you know, purchase like gasoline, food, or things, at least for the short term. Can he delve further in it? Have there been any other ideas, getting the government to bring emergency money, I think, is not going to work like we saw in New Orleans.
Well, Dick, I'm glad you brought this up because there are actually some sort of parallel historical examples that David talks about in the book.
Yes, one in particular was it was either the early 70s or the late 60s when there was a banking strike in Ireland. And, you know, that is the equivalent of, you know, a calamity that would knock out the power grid. And everyone thought that commerce would grind to a halt. But in fact, everyone there just started circulating handwritten IOUs. And they work just fine as money, as currency. Again, you know, because money is just this idea and you have to believe that it works. And everyone believed these pieces of paper had value, a little bit like the IOUs issued by the state of California a couple of years ago. And so people had a suitable medium of exchange and store of value. Having said that, you know, I think that's an interesting anecdote. But on the other hand, I think there needs to be a little bit of a reality check about sort of the quaintness of the communities involved. In other words, when I shared that anecdote with someone in Los Angeles, he said, you know, you've got to be kidding yourself if you think Angelenos are going to transact peacefully with handwritten IOUs in the wake of a giant earthquake on the West Coast. And so I think the caller, you know, has a good point, and it's probably one of the strongest points in defense of cash as we know it now. But, you know, I'm not so pessimistic as to think that some future technology might not be able to compensate for that if we want it, right? If we find that the cost of cash are just so enormous compared to the benefits, not 2 years from now, but 22 years from now, that that maybe we find a way to end around it that would even work during that disaster scenario.
Talk a little bit more about your year-long experiment with no cash. There was one place where you found you could not hold out.
Well, there were a few little episodes. You know, I was in the summertime here jogging by a lemonade stand on the street corner. I was the Grinch many days in a row. The same kids must think this guy is such a jerk with the same sorry excuse for not having any money on him. There was also a time when I couldn't pay the babysitter. My wife didn't have cash to pay the babysitter, and I couldn't convince her father to establish a PayPal account on the fly. And so I had to pay there because I wasn't going to, you know, rob the babysitter for the sake of this literary experiment.
Yeah.
But then, of course, I think what you're hinting at is when I got to India.
Yes.
Because, you know, as soon as I got there, before the plane even pulled up to the terminal, I realized I have to call a timeout on this experiment, because unless I want to just hunker down in my hotel room for 6 days when I need to be out in the field reporting this for this book, I need to use cash. You know, if I want to buy bottled water or pay a translator or food or taxi or anything, I need cash. And that was, you know, that was important realization for a number of reasons. One, of course, it clarified that while we may be pretty close to the cashless future here in more developed countries, you know, in the developing world, cash is really dug in its heels and is crucial at the everyday level, and people are using it all the time every day, whereas you and I could go a few weeks without using cash and barely notice it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, that was an important point, but it also was a helpful way to sort of enter into this conversation about how cash is most punitive for the people who have so little of it, because there in India I could see people transacting with cash and talking with local economists and things. I could understand a little bit better how costly cash is for them.
David Woolman is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. His new book is called The End of Money: Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. David, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellani answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about our upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.